This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to No Lies Radio.
In the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome to the special live version of Truth Jihad Radio here on Revolution Radio, the best listener-sponsored outfit out there. Go to revolution.radio. Give what you can. Subscribe. Help us out. Great show coming up here tonight. My colleague from, well, the world of Islamic studies, Dr. John Andrew Morrow, will be joining me shortly in the first hour. Dr. John Andrew Morrow has a brand new book out from Cambridge Scholars. It's called Islam and the People of the Book. I contributed an article. So we'll be talking about that and the sad state of, what shall we call them, interfaith relations. This the craziness in the Christian and Muslim worlds that keeps people misunderstanding each other and sometimes even fighting each other. And then in the second hour, Sam Harris, no, not Sam Harris, Mike Harris, a much better guy than Sam Harris, to say the least, will be coming on to talk about VTTV. What is VTTV? That's Veterans Today TV. It's decisive action to counteract U.S. government-driven internet censorship and spying. If you don't want to be spied on, you can sign up, get an email address, get Facebook-type social media capability, all of it totally impenetrable with 512 encryption. That means the NSA can't even unlock it. It would take them centuries to unlock your communications. So you can use your communications, you know, for totally free of spying, and you can broadcast. So who knows how many shows will be moving over there at some point. Let's hear more about it, at least, in the second hour from Mike Harris of Veterans Today. So, all right, let's get going here. We started a minute or two late. Let's see if we can pull up Dr. John Morrow. Dr. John Morrow is a very cool guy. He's not afraid of the truth, and he's taking decisive action to try to fix some of the things that have gotten broken since 9/11 and the war on Islam got launched. Of course, things were broken even before that. The new book, Islam and the People of the Book, looks really interesting. And so let's talk about it. Hey, welcome, Dr. John Krumora. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to be on your program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's always good to have you back. I think you're a real voice of sanity, crying out in the wilderness these days. It's so bizarre how the mainstream and majority communities are so ill-informed about everything having to do with Islam, in particular how the Christian community, especially here in the U.S., is constantly, you know, fed this horrible, bizarre anti-Islam propaganda, deceiving them into thinking that Muslims are these very strange, fanatical creatures who worship a totally strange God, you know. When in fact, Christianity and Islam are very close. I mean, one could, you know, I sometimes tell Christians, well, I'm sort of a Christian too. I'm a Muslim, and Islam is really just a slightly, you know, an unusually sensible version of Christianity. We, you know, we share most of your beliefs, and the few that we don't are very much in line with the Unitarians. So if the Unitarians are Christians, why, we might as well be thought of as Christians too. Of course, that's, I don't know, what do you think about that argument?
Well, I was at a Catholic Muslim forum in Indianapolis in the recent past, and one of the Catholic priests there, one of the fathers, asked me about my journey from Catholicism to Islam. And I mentioned, you know, that I entered into Islam because, well, I described it as a question of degree. I spoke of minor theological differences. And there was a Muslim sister who was there with me, and, you know, she found that a little bit unusual. But, you know, the difference between 1 degree is the difference between a liquid and a solid. And so, you know, if you focus on similarities, there's a great deal in common there.
And if you focus on differences, it seems that the Christians I know don't really seem to have much of an answer. You know, I just published a piece essentially, you know, outlining these kind of key differences in outlook between Christians and Muslims, which, frankly, I think show that common sense, for the most part, favors the Muslims. And Christians have even had to say, credo ad absurdum, I believe it because it's absurd. And I asked the Christians to kind of explain, you know, why they choose this Trinitarianism, this belief in original sin, and this, you know, total focus on the crucifixion as necessary to redeem everybody, as opposed to God being perfect, creation being essentially perfect, and everyone being responsible for their own actions, and Jesus being a divine messenger. I mean, this all seems pretty commonsensical. But maybe there's something I'm missing. I keep asking Christians to explain it to me, and they never really can. So yeah. I don't know. So I would really rather focus on the similarities, because I can't get a good conversation going about the differences.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when we talk about the Catholics, they're very much following the Jesus of tradition. The Protestants are following the Jesus of Paul, and we Muslims are following the Jesus of history. The Muslim view and understanding of Jesus is very, very close to the historical accounts of his life and his actions. And so there may be differences between these approaches and these understandings, but we're all still basically following Jesus. And so, yes, I think it's far more productive to focus on the things that we have in common. And although we do have some differences, and those differences are important, and those differences are, you know, at the root of our different traditions. If we discuss these things, we have to do it in a calm and respectful fashion.
And if we back up and take a look at the big picture,
yes,
it seems that both Christians and Muslims are really heretics in a sense in today's world, because the dominant religion of the elites, and to a large extent, more and more, it seems, a fair number of ordinary people, is progressivist secular humanism, a worship of the human being. And there are various permutations. There's a worship of the human being as, you know, perfectible working class revolutionary among the communists. There's the worship of the human being as the great leader who solves the problems of the nation, the fascists. There's the liberal version, which is the dominant version here in the United States, which essentially worships letting the capitalists do any darn thing they want, while pretending to be all respectful of human rights and transgender people and things like that. But all of these are just various spins and permutations on progressivist secular humanism that arose out of this revolt against Christianity. So Christians and Muslims are both heretics in a world dominated by progressivist secular humanists. We really ought to unite as worshipers of God and defend ourselves, because, you know, we're under the gun now. I mean, this secular humanism, it's not a kind, gentle, kind of tolerant faith like it pretends to be. It's actually quite intolerant at times and quite militant, and it's going to run over us if we don't stand up for ourselves. And that means Christians standing up for Muslims and Muslims standing up for Christians.
Yes, I would agree with you entirely. We live in a world of secularism, capitalism, materialism, and hedonism. And although they profess to be liberal and to be tolerant, you just have to scratch the surface, and you will see, the profound hatred that they have towards people who believe in God and people who believe in traditional values and morals.
And speaking of intolerance and hatred, I was just thrown off of a scheduled interview. I was supposed to be on KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon this morning. And suddenly, out of nowhere, it seems the Antifa people, or somebody purporting to represent Antifa, got a big complaint going, claiming that I was a crazed conspiracy-mongering anti-Semite. And then they provided a list of articles, which actually, you know, that I wrote, that are, I think, all quite sensible and totally defensible. The trouble is, nobody has time to actually read them. And so this happens every time I try to do something. It seems that this kind of, these gang stalkers, who are all basically agents of Israel or ardent, passionate defenders of Israel, follow me around. Every time I'm planning to do an interview here, publish something there, give a talk here, whatever, boom, these people write their poison pen letters. They try to get me shut down. And 99% of the time they fail, because people generally do their due diligence if they have time to, and they look at the stuff that these stalkers provide, and they say, what's wrong with that? But this time, apparently the people at KBOO didn't have time to actually look at the links that these gang stalkers sent them. So they just canceled this interview at the last minute. And this kind of really extreme stalking that follows me kind of everywhere I go, every time I try to do anything, these people are there almost before I even got there with their poison pen letters and so on. I cannot imagine how anybody could put that much energy into trying to sort of ruin the efforts of a writer and public speaker and broadcaster. It boggles my mind. Where do they get people who have so much energy to do that, and to do that so deceptively and so hatefully?
Yes, and these are people who pretend to believe in free speech. When there's a voice of reason and clarity and intelligent voice out there, they will try to ignore you. Then they will laugh at you, and, you know, claim that you're a quack. Then they will attack you, and it could be by means of the pen, or it could be by means, more violent means. But then eventually you win. So it's very important to persist and to speak truth to power, come what may.
That's what I'm trying to do. And hopefully they will eventually sit down and take a look at, you know, a couple of articles I wrote. It seems like the Holocaust is a topic that really either sets these people off, or they just find it really useful as something to try to, a club to bludgeon you with. So, you know, I've very strongly defended the idea that the Holocaust, and of course there are dozens and dozens of Holocausts and genocides, but all of them should be equally open to historical inquiry. None of them should be put on a pedestal and made into sacred stories that is myths that you have to endorse and sort of bow down and worship, or else you'll go to prison or be deprived of your livelihood, et cetera, et cetera. So I've strongly supported free speech on that issue. And, you know, if you speak out against the witch hunt, you must be a witch. And so they, you know, they'll link an article of mine defending free speech on this and other topics and say, you know, frame it by saying, oh, look, Kevin Barrett's a Holocaust denier. Here's an article he wrote about the Holocaust. And they'll send a link to the article. And nobody has time to actually read the article. So they just figure, oh, yeah, he must be one of those crazy Holocaust deniers. We don't want that on our station. And, you know, and it's really kind of an uphill battle, you know, trying to push back against this.
And it's especially difficult considering we're living in a period of time where people don't read, and they get information from social media and from Facebook posts. You get all these likes and these dislikes, and you know they're just responding to the title. They actually haven't even clicked on it. They haven't read it.
Well, people need to start reading. You know, maybe get off the internet, read some actual physical books.
Absolutely. They should head to their local library. Yes, they should turn off their phones and crack open a book, and they will see wonders, no doubt. See, social media obviously has its benefits, but increasingly it's evident that it is a tool that is being used not to inform people, but to manipulate people and to control people on a large scale. So we have to be very wary of that.
We sure do. Well, that's what my second hour tonight is about. I'm going to be bringing on Mike Harris of Veterans Today. He's also a broadcaster here on Revolution Radio, and he's starting or helping start an effort called VTTV. It's associated with Veterans Today,
yes.
And it's using 512 encryption, which apparently they tell me the NSA can't even break. They would have to work at it for centuries to break it, maybe decades, I don't know. But it's really good encryption. And there'll be social media, email accounts, and posting and broadcast capabilities there. Nobody can spy on you. You know, the big data mongers will never get any of your data. And that, you know, migrating to that kind of space makes a lot of sense.
I would certainly agree.
To the extent you're going to stay online.
Yes.
So you have a new book out, speaking of reading books, Islam and the People of the Book. Coming out from Cambridge Scholars. Now, are they associated with Cambridge University?
No. That publisher was founded by scholars and academics from Cambridge University. And so they started their own independent academic press. So that's their connection with Cambridge. So they're an independent academic press.
All right. And so what's kind of the general theme of Islam and the People of the Book?
Well, Islam and the People of the Book is a follow-up to the Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World that was published in 2013 by a small Sufi press and a Catholic press, a book that was very successful and very influential, alhamdulillah. And so we immediately started to work on Islam and the People of the Book after the publication of the Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World. I put out a call for papers, and I invited scholars to contribute to this new field of study of on the Covenants of the Prophet. And so this work, it's a three-volume work, so it's essentially an encyclopedia, is the joint effort of 45 academics and intellectuals and translators and so on. It contains 36 scholarly studies and over a dozen translations of the Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad, the six main ones. And so these are now available in English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, Dutch, Russian, Tamil, Indonesian, Persian, Azeri, Arabic, and Turkish. So, alhamdulillah, many scholars have joined this caravan and are studying and disseminating these letters and treaties that the Prophet Muhammad concluded with the People of the Book.
And these documents from the earliest days of Islam have been preserved carefully in various locations by various people, including the monks at Mount Sinai. That's one of the most interesting locations where Christians and Muslims work together and have for many centuries, actually for over 1,000 years, almost since Islam came to the world 1,400 years ago, with these covenants that require Muslims to protect Christians and treat Christians very, very well. And essentially consider them, brothers in our faith. And this is such an interesting thing that all of this has existed for all this time. And then along comes the post 9/11 world with Wahhabism on steroids, being juiced up and proffered as the next big civilizational enemy. And most of it's being juiced up by the usual big powers and political players here in the West, Zionism above all, but to some extent, the U.S. empire and other big time power interests. They essentially created or funded, and propagated and publicized this ultra Wahhabi version of Islam, or deviation from Islam, really, that's become, it's sucked up all the attention. And so, it put the word Islam on everybody's lips, put the image of Islam on everybody's TV screen, and then gave them pictures of the exploding twin towers with the pyroclastic dust clouds from the explosives chasing people through the streets of New York and, you know, giving half the people in the U.S. post-traumatic stress disorder and associating this with the word Islam. And then this is like all we've seen since then is these, you know, head choppers of ISIS and these kind of people. And that's what people think of now when they think of Islam for the most part. So this is quite an interesting moment, especially now that ISIS is on the run. And it seems that this Salafi jihadi thing is on the run. It's on the wane. The covenants may be coming into a more propitious time. Do you think that the next decade or two could be a time when there's a lot more movement towards recognizing this aspect of Islam?
I believe so, and I certainly hope so, and I pray that that will be the case. The covenants of the Prophet were well known to Muslims and to Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians for most of Islamic history, until the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans actually based their domestic policy and the structure of their empire on the covenants of the Prophet. They created a millet system from the word milla, which means like community. And so it was, they had, the Jewish community followed Jewish law, and they had Jewish judges, and the Christian community followed Christian law, and they had Christian judges. And so all of these communities had rights as part of this ummah, or this community of Islam. And so the Jews had the rights, the Christians had the rights, other minorities had the rights. This was the system that was in operation and that worked very well. But as you mentioned, Wahhabism surfaces and it takes control of the Holy Land and Arabia, and it spread throughout the world as a result of their oil wealth and universities and publishing and so on. So yes, we hope and pray that we can return to a system that was tried and tested and proved to be highly beneficial.
The idea of different communities living side by side, but operating according to their own rules, actually having their own laws, their own mechanisms for judging disputes, their own practices of what's licit and what's illicit, such as, for example, in almost all Islamic lands throughout history, there were Christians living there who ran their own affairs to the extent that they could drink alcohol in their own homes, their own neighborhoods, and so on, and Muslims couldn't. So each community gets...
Yes, Kevin, you're absolutely right. That is the level of tolerance. You have these Wahhabis, these Salafis, these Takfiris who believe that they should impose their perverted misinterpretation of Islamic law on all people, and that, you know, Christians and Jews and non-Muslims have to follow Islamic law. That is not the truth. That was not the case in Islamic history. That is not how things were done in the Ottoman Empire, nor was that the way things were done in the Safavid Empire. So both in the Sunni world and in the Shi'i world, this is the system that was in place. You have a Safavid leader, for example, like Shah Abbas. Shah Abbas ensured that wine was available to the Christians. He actually imported over 1,000 pigs, okay, so that the Christian community in New Julfa, in Isfahan, could have pork. Now, we as Muslims, we do not eat pork, but we do not impose that on other people. And now, so for some so-called fundamentalists and so on, this is, you know, what are you talking about? This is an Islamic. Well, how about we go back 1400 years? How about we go to the time of the fourth caliph? What is the first thing that Imam Ali did after he assumed the caliphate? He went up on the minbar and he gave a very important speech. And in that speech, he said that he would judge the Muslims on the basis of the Quran, and he would judge the Christians on the basis of the gospel, and he would judge the Jews on the basis of the Torah, so that each of those books would testify to God that Ali had fulfilled them. And so this goes back all the way to the four rightly guided caliphs. And so following in the footsteps and in the example of the Prophet Muhammad when it comes to tolerance.
And some would argue that this is even more tolerant than the modern world.
Absolutely. People with power are judged on how they treat the powerless. You judge a majority based on how it treats its minorities. And so, you know, just like Muslims shouldn't impose their values and their morals and so on and their rules and regulations on non-Muslims, these secular liberals shouldn't impose their values upon people of faith.
I think it's Marina Menakal who wrote a book called The Ornament of the World about Andalusia and these amazingly tolerant conditions that she writes about in Andalusia were actually, for the most part, the norm in Muslim societies throughout history. She makes the argument that this is actually more tolerant than the modern world, that modernity comes in and tries to force everybody to be the same. And that's why we have these nation states today where it's threatening in, even in the U.S., people panic about Sharia law coming into America. I hope they're not panicking, that imagining that somehow the American Constitution is going to be overthrown in favor of Islamic law, but what they point to is cases where Muslims sign some kind of agreement for having arbitration to cover whatever it is, what business transaction or family matter or something, by way of Islamic tradition. And just having people making that agreement to have arbitration under Islamic tradition, it doesn't affect anybody else, just panics them. And in France, it's even worse. In France, this national identity has to be 100% secular. And so the police run around ripping the clothes off of women on the beaches. So frankly, this Islamic system, this medieval Islamic system that lets people live side by side in their own communities, running their own affairs, even having totally different rules from the other communities, in certain respects really does seem like a huge advance. If we could go back to that, maybe we would actually be creating a more truly tolerant world.
I would agree, and we can just look at what happened after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Under Islamic rule, the Christians were protected, the Jews were protected, the Muslims were protected. But then the Western imperialists come, and they turn people against one another. They encourage nationalism. They convince the Assyrians that they should have their own country. They convince the Arabs that they should have their own country. They try to convince the Armenians that they should have their own country and that they should abandon Islam and abandon the Muslims and create states based on race and nationality and ethnicity and religion. They convince them to govern themselves the way the Westerners were governing themselves, to create secular states. And it was a complete and total catastrophe. It led to mass murder. It led to genocide. And so that is the fruit of spreading, Western secular ideas in the Muslim world.
And when we ask ourselves, where do these secular ideas come from? It seems that part of the answer lies in the wars of religion that ripped apart Western Europe about 500 years ago. And the survivors of that horrific episode decided that they had to get away from religion because these polities that were based on Catholicism and Protestantism had been going at each other's throats and decimating each other. And so religion kind of got blamed for that in Western culture. That may be one reason for the strong move away from religion towards sort of secularism, nationalism, and these various forms of progressivist secular humanism. But I wonder if there isn't something built into Christianity that made this possible, because humanism is the worship of the human. And yes, Christianity involves a certain kind of worship of the human by this intentional confusion of the human and divine natures in Jesus, alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. So yes. that worship of the guy, you know, this human being on the cross, and this notion of this three in one God involving the Father, that's pretty anthropomorphic. You know, what's a father? It's an old human with a beard. What's the Son? He's a young human, you know, and both male, of course. So it seems like these people are sort of worshiping an anthropomorphized two human image of God. And despite the Christians and the mystics who know that God is really the Godhead, not some old hairy guy with a beard on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, I think that Christians with this habit of worshiping the human and worshiping these statues and pictures of these people, and then they start finding the Greco-Roman statues and stuff, and they really get into these images of humans. And pretty soon they're bowing down before the image of the human being. And this leads to all these permutations of fascism and communism and liberalism and what have you. But it's all worship of the human being. And I wonder if that doesn't come out of this sort of error of Christianity in overly anthropomorphizing God.
Yes, I mean, it may trace back to this whole notion of giving to Caesar, you know, what belongs to Caesar, this division between the church and state, which does have, you know, root in the New Testament. But in the Muslim world, we never had that problem of separating the state from the mosque. In Islam, we describe Allah as being just. He is just, and he is also merciful, and he's the lawgiver. And it's these rights and these protections and these privileges that were given by God that we are supposed to follow and to implement. I mean, if we look at the Constitution of Medina, and if we look at the covenants of the Prophet Muhammad, the Prophet states very clearly that this is being all of these rights, you know, freedom of religion, freedom of expression and association, all of these rights and protections came from God. And so it is God who is giving these rights to humans. Huh? So it's a very different perspective.
The founding fathers in the U.S. kind of saw that. There's natural law.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Another area where Christians and Muslims can agree, whereas the secular, progressivist secular humanists would, I suppose, say that they would have to, you know, cast all of this in doubt, the notion of God-given rights, and they would be saying that, well, no, human beings are working it all out themselves. But one of the many problems with that is that the rules that are thus generated are simply human constructions and hence don't really deserve any more consideration than really any other human construction. So as the guy's name is John Paul Wolf wrote, there's in Defense of Anarchy, there's no real reason to obey the law if you're a totally secular person.
Yes, absolutely. These laws, these rules are not sacred, and they were created by human beings and can be changed by human beings, and hence they evolve. But we believe that there are certain fundamental things that cannot and should not change.
And by having that kind of a sort of metaphysical basis for law and for the whole society, it does seem that's in harmony with human nature. All societies have had some kind of way of incorporating this human desire for transcendence and the, you know, the cultural fruit of transcendence, what we in Islam would talk about as prophetic revelations, divine messengers and such. In some cultures, these may have been shamanic. In some cultures, they may have been other, you know, Buddha or the whoever was behind the Upanishads and so on. Sources of contact with something that transcends the human and material level is incorporated into the very basis of social systems. And now we're trying to have one that is completely cut off from that. I don't think that's going to work very well. I mean, it may keep
no,
on.
And, We had the experience of socialism and communism. They wanted to create a new world. They wanted to give people all kinds of rights. But then after decades of communist rule, you look at the results, how moral values eroded, how, you know, you look at the breakdown of the family. You even find a person like Fidel Castro, towards the end of his life, encouraging Cubans to return to religion, because he had seen the damage that this secular ideology had on the population of Cuba. And you find the same thing in Russia. After communism collapsed, you had a people who, by and large, were devoid of morals and values.
Indeed, and we're seeing a lot more of that now. I just had a couple of interesting radio conversations with people who describe themselves as feminists.
Yes,
and we were discussing this Me Too movement and things like that. Barbara Honegger, former presidential advisor, came on and talked about how she practically flipped Reagan on the abortion question by mm-hmm. her argument that abortion could never be made illegal under any circumstances, because that would amount to a taking of a person's organ, that is the womb, enslaving a woman to her organ, in the same way that, you know, forcibly taking bone marrow from a potential donor would be enslaving them. So anyway, I had all that kind of discussion, you know, with people from various types of sort of feminist ideologies about this Me Too movement. And it seems to me that a lot of that discussion is wrongheaded, in that it imagines that further, quote unquote, progress in the direction of this progressivist, secular, humanist dispensation is going to somehow solve the problem that it's actually created, that by taking away the sacred rules, it's actually opened the door to this kind of egotistical misbehavior. And it seems to me that the way to rein it in and improve the situation is to bring back the dimension of the sacred that leads us to give up our egos and our egotistical bodily desires, step aside from them, step back from them in favor of something higher, that's the kind of world that actually can be relatively free of these kinds of crimes against women.
Yes, indeed.
And so the dominant discourse tells us that Islam, with its traditional social structures, is patriarchal and part of a system that systematically oppresses women. That has not been my experience from what I've observed of my fellow Muslims from various countries, including here in the United States. Maybe you could speak to that.
Well, I mean, every country is different. So it's very difficult to generalize. I mean, I can speak about Islam. I think Islam creates a wonderful system in which the rights of men and women and children and society as a whole are protected. Islam is a system that is in balance. And if you break that balance, then, you know, societal structure starts to disintegrate and crumble and fall apart.
And we are seeing that now. We're also seeing a lot of turmoil in the heartland of Islam, where Islam was born. It seems, though, that the defeat of so-called ISIS, which deceptively took the name Islamic State to justify a lot of very un-Islamic practices, is on the run. Do you have hopes that this region is going to recover, or are we seeing, you know, just a kind of a shift in gears of the big powers that are bent on destabilizing it?
Well, it's very difficult to foretell. The balance in the world is always is constantly changing and shifting. So it's difficult to say. I mean, how do you feel about it, Kevin? Are you optimistic about the situation in the Middle East and in the Muslim world?
You know, not really in the short term too much. I mean, I think it's, I suppose it's good that there's at least a possibility of stability in Syria, of the Americans getting out of Iraq and maybe Syria as well, although it's not at all clear that's going to happen. They're keeping, 60,000 trained militia guys who are not that different from ISIS and related groups under U.S. command in Syria, illegally occupying that country.
Yeah.
So it's changing perhaps slowly for the better, but it seems that the people that created all this chaos are bent on continuing it. They're not in any hurry to let it end. And so I don't know. I'm not all that hopeful. It does seem to me that the single biggest cause of this destruction in the region has been the hardline Zionism of people like Netanyahu. I think those people they're very, very defensive and very paranoid, you know, imagining that everybody hates the Jews and wants to throw us into the sea. So we have to be super vicious and super preemptive and, you know, run around assassinating people. The Israelis are the world's champion of assassinations, even though they're a tiny little country. Run around doing terror attacks. They're the world's leading terrorists, even though they're a tiny little country. The country was created by terrorism and it never stopped, mostly shifted to false flag terrorism. And so I think they're so fanatical and driven by this bizarre, neurotic belief that everybody hates them and wants to kill them, when in fact the history of conflict between Jewish and non-Jewish communities is very much a two-way street. There have been reasons for trouble on both sides throughout history, but they have this ideology that it's all on them. You know, we've had conflicts with hundreds of groups. Everybody we've lived among has hated us, and it's always been their fault, not at all our fault. And it taken to its extreme, this leads us to the philosophy of people like Netanyahu and the neoconservatives. And they're so desperate to try to make this little settler colonial regime outlive its period in history that, you know, they put out that memo in 1996, the Clean Break document, you know, saying we're going to have to totally redraw the whole map of the Middle East in blood if necessary in order to help Israel transcend its enemies, not just defeat them, but actually transcend them. And to do that, I'm convinced they were the single biggest players behind the 9/11 false flag event, which drove the war on Islam that has continued ever since, and particularly the war on Israel's Middle Eastern antagonists. Many of those countries have been largely destroyed due to this. And I don't see them turning around and saying, oops, we made a huge mistake. We never should have done these things. We want to live in peace with our neighbors. That's what it would take to.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't see it happening anytime soon. It looks like they may take down Netanyahu in a bribery scandal, but I don't see that really changing the nature of power in Israel.
No. I'm afraid I have to agree with you. I'm not expecting any major changes in Israel in the near future. Everything that takes place in the Muslim world and the world as a whole has to do with the policies of the United States and Israel. And for a period, they had free rein to cause chaos and to destabilize that part of the world. Russian actions in the region have helped to contain that chaos. It's a game, and they're all playing their hands, and we will have to see how it develops.
Well, some favorable trends would include the waning of the U.S. power. The Israelis have typically used the U.S. to get their dirty work done. But now the U.S. is sort of receding from the region. And into that vacuum come Russia, Iran, Turkey, these sort of more independent countries without an interest in smashing up the region. In fact, the opposite interest. So I think that's a hopeful trend. Another hopeful trend is that younger Jewish people in the West, including here in the U.S., are waking up and seeing that Israel is not something that they really want to be identified with and associated with. And the BDS movement is gaining all the time, panicking the powers that be, the AIPAC types. The AIPAC just had their big conference, and it actually garnered a fair bit of relatively negative mainstream coverage. And mm-hmm. so the sort of liberal Jewish people who are so numerous in our media are not as tightly wedded to Israel as they used to be. They're seeing some of this extremism for what it is. The younger they are, the more likely they are to be waking up and getting it. So I think there's a lot of hope there. The younger generation of Jewish people is starting to question the wisdom of this insanity that their elders have been pushing. So between that and the waning of the U.S. imperial power in the world, and especially in the Middle East, I think these long-term trends open up some very positive possibilities.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. And then there's the million-dollar question. I think the real core of a lot of this is, and a lot of other things, is the usury currency system, you know. And here's another place where Islam really can contribute something to solving the political problems of the world, the Islamic condemnation of usury. Our currency yes. system right now, it's run by private banksters. They issue the entire world's currency by lending it into existence at interest. And it all has to be paid back to those same private bankers who created it out of nothing at interest. And we have to pay back the interest, too. So yes. it's a Ponzi scheme, and all the money's going to them. And this kills the economy. It's killing the planet, because people have to work more and more frenetically to try to pay back all of the unpayable exponential interest. And to do that, you know, we chop down all the forests, and we, you know, we sell the cheapest stuff that we can make a profit on. We, you know, grow GMO food. All, you know, we create crap. I mean, usury yes. causes a huge degradation in the quality of everything. And Islam sees that. It's right there in the Quran. You know, the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, says that you practice usury and he's coming for you. You know, the Quran says that anybody who practices usury is at war with God and his prophet. So Islam has a very strong stance there. Christianity, too. The only time Jesus yes. ever raised his hand in anger was against the money changers, the users who'd taken over the temple. There's something very important about that. So maybe this is where Christians and Muslims need to unite. We need to overthrow this satanic international bankster cabal and institute honest currency, preferably interest-free, riba-free. The Islamic world really needs to do this. You know, every Muslim country right now is still in the clutches of usury. This is completely unacceptable. I mean, the Quran is so clear about this. Yeah, so I think this is along with the issue that you've taken up, this is the other critically important issue for Muslims and Christians to unite on.
Yes, all world religions condemn usury.
There's a reason for that.
Absolutely. I mean, with the Covenants Initiative and so on, we're trying to protect people and protect communities and human beings and so on. This is just, you know, one issue. You mentioned the economic issue and the political issue. The system as it exists needs to change. It's not tenable. It is leading this world to a complete and total catastrophe. So if we want this world to survive and humanity to survive, then we're going to have to put an end to capitalism and globalism.
Well, I recently had Peter Koenig on my show. He's a whistleblowing former World Bank economist. Yes. And he is quite optimistic about the Venezuelan Petro, which is a cryptocurrency backed by Venezuelan oil, which they have the biggest reserves in the world. He thinks that could work. And I said, well, you know, what if the Islamic world did this? Because the Islamic world has, if you take it all together, they have a whole lot more reserves even than Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we Muslims are supposed to pay our zakat in gold and silver, you know, real money, not riba money. What if the Islamic world united around a common currency, a cryptocurrency backed by energy resources, just like Venezuela is doing? And then made it a non-user currency. And Peter, God bless him, said, yeah, that's a great idea. So, again, that's another inshallah, I guess.
Yes, no, I mean, in Islam we have zakat and we have khums and other religious traditions. They mandate charity. I mean, if the billionaires of this world paid their due share, they would eradicate poverty seven times over. There is no reason for people to starve to death and to live in misery on this planet. The more you have, the more you're responsible to share and to contribute. But we live in an extremely selfish world.
Well, that's really key to a lot of Islamic injunctions, isn't it? The need to take care of people, especially the needy and the poor. I mean, that's over. We hear that over and over directly in Quran, and we also can see that that's the reason for a lot of the social rules. You know, the reason why men were limited to having four wives, but not limited to one at that time, was to take care of the women who needed someone to take care of them. And the way that that society could do that was through marriage. And likewise, you know, the marriage rules are all about making sure that children know who their fathers are so they can demand support from their fathers. The Quran's telling us to stop killing the baby girls, and on and on and on. Well, so much of it is about taking care of people. Well, Dr. Morrow, we are at the end of the hour, but it's been wonderful as always. I love talking with you, and I look forward to crossing paths with you, maybe at the Muslim Congress next year. I do hope to be there, inshallah.
Yes, inshallah. We'll see you there. Thank you. Okay. God bless.
Bye-bye. Salam. That's Dr. John Andrew Morrow. He's the editor of the new Islam and the People of the Book, as well as the critically important Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World. Kevin Barrett, truthjihad.com. Be back in a moment. Mike Harris talking about Veterans Today TV, VTTV, the solution to internet spying and censorship.
Sacred Matrix.
Welcome back to the live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett on here every Friday evening, telling it like it is and finding other people who can do the same thing. Well, one of the ways that it is, is cyberspace is becoming less and less free. There's been a drive to censor the internet and perhaps more insidiously to feed everything on the internet into big data machines that use artificial intelligence algorithms to get to know you better than you know yourself so they can manipulate you below the level of consciousness, turn you into their robot. I don't like this. You shouldn't either. There is no reason why anybody should ever be allowed to spy on you on the internet. There is no reason why Facebook should be allowed to keep track of what you like and what you don't like. Frankly, I think you have the right to go and burn down the Facebook headquarters if they try that. And they do. They do it to you every day. This is an outrage. This is an assault on your privacy. It's an assault on your mind. You need to rise up against this, folks. And here's one way to do it without actually going and burning down their headquarters and getting arrested for arson. We wouldn't want to advocate that. No, no, that's not a good idea. Don't even think of that. Don't try that at home. Instead, try to go sign up for Veterans Today TV, veteranstodaytv.com. Check out VTTV, and you'll get 512K encryption and all sorts of other goodies. And to talk about that, we're going to bring on Mike Harris, who is a prime guy for setting up VTTV. Mike Harris is my colleague at Veterans Today, and he's the point man behind this. Let's find out more about it, because I don't know that much about it yet. I pretty much know what I've read in the terrific Preston James article that we linked at the radio blog, so people can read that. But let's get Mike on and talk about it. Hey, welcome, Mike Harris. How are you doing? Hello, Mike. Oh, I thought we had Mike on the line. But I don't hear him. Mike, unmute your mic. Okay. Well, maybe we'll figure this out in a second. Let me send him a quick message here. How are we going to get Mike's voice on here? don't know if there's a bandwidth issue going on here or what. So we're gonna wait till we hear Mike. And until then, I guess I can tell you a little bit more about VTTV myself, even though I don't know nearly as much about it as Mike Harris does. This Preston James article, published on February 28th, discusses how we now have such a need for this. Okay, it looks like I have to call him back. So let's try this. Okay. Oops. Is that going to work? I don't know.
Okay, let's try it this time.
Oh, there he is. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I can hear you perfectly, but obviously you weren't hearing me. So we switched formats here. Went from the laptop to the cell phone, where I'm getting you Skype now. So, all right. Cool. So here we are. I missed part of the introduction here because I was trying to reconnect.
Well, hey, obviously you know your stuff. You've got your devices set up, and you can, if one doesn't work, you can jump on the other one. That's the kind of guy we need to work with something like VTTV. You know, and I think you've identified a really important problem here. The internet is increasingly censored, and it's increasingly spied on. These big data algorithms are sucking up everything we do and using it to manipulate us below the level of consciousness. So between the spying and the censorship, the internet just ain't what it used to be. And you're saying that just by, you know, paying a few bucks to have a secure server with 512 encryption, we can change that and basically end the spying and the censorship.
Well, absolutely. That's the entire intention behind this project. You know, you look at what Facebook does to people. You submit your photographs, you tell them your life story, you tell them where you're going on vacation, you give all this stuff. And so they build these profiles on you, and they take all this information and they aggregate it across millions and millions of people. And then they sell it to third parties, either corporations or governments or whoever is willing to pay the price. And so really, you know, if you're not paying for it, for the product, then you are the product. And so that's what Facebook is. And people don't even realize that they are the product that Facebook buys and sells. And that's
Soylent Green is people.
Soylent Green is people. Exactly. And so what we decided to do is, we located servers offshore. We took a page out of the NSA's manual, out of their playbook. And that is the way the NSA is getting around the new restrictions on their data collection domestically in the U.S. is they still collect the data in the U.S., but they stream it offshore. It's called stream shaping. So we thought, well, gosh, if the NSA can do it, it's good enough for them, we can do the same thing. So we located our servers offshore so that they're out of U.S. jurisdiction, because this 512 encryption that we've developed is unique. It's not legal in the USA. U.S. people, U.S. businesses can't use it. And the reason is because it would take the NSA 1,000 years to decrypt it.
Wait a minute. Let me stop you there, Mike, because that is so crazy. Now, the NSA, by its charter, is not allowed to spy on Americans. And yet, there's a law to make sure that no Americans use strong encryption so that the NSA can spy on them, which the NSA is not supposed to do. Meanwhile, the rest of the world outside our borders, where the NSA is supposed to be able to spy, can use good encryption and foil the NSA. And this is so crazy.
Well, it is. It's the point where form overtakes substance. And the whole issue with the NSA streaming, you know, data streaming offshore, it's really like we pull this out of their playbook. It was really a brilliant move for them to avoid U.S. jurisdictional problems with U.S. law enforcement here by breaking our own laws. That's what the NSA does when they do this. So they avoid it by putting their data collection overseas, and they pull it off the pipeline, you know, the fiber optic cables over there, and they collect as much as they want, and nobody even bats an eye at it.
So we
took a page out of that playbook. And so we did that. We're behind a banking class firewall. And if anybody out there who's got hacking skills has ever tried to hack a bank, good luck. So we're behind a banking class firewall, and we have 512 encryption. So what this means is that even if the NSA intercepts one of your messages, it's going to take them 1,000 years to decrypt it. So send away. Let's eat up as much of their computer time as we possibly can and make them go over budget and make them look like they're not doing their job. That's part of the project here. But it really is effective. And, you know, we've developed a Facebook replacement that, you know, you get it for your $1.99 a month, your little subscription there. And when you go on it, it'll look and feel and behave like Facebook. If you want to post your pictures, you want to, you know, say you like something or you dislike something, it's there. You can make comments. You can reply to comments. You can tell them where you had dinner. You can take pictures of your food and post them. Anything you want to do. It's made specifically so that people who've been on Facebook and have enjoyed the experience can come on to our site at VTTV and enjoy the experience as well. It's going to be like getting a Ford versus a Chevy. They're both automobiles. The steering wheel's on the left side. The gas pedal's where it belongs. The ignition's where it belongs. It's going to be just like that, except that we're not Facebook and you're not the product. And we charge a meager $1.99 for people to be able to take their privacy back, to take their, you know, to not be data mined. I mean, how many times have you been on a site and you're looking at wheelbarrows at Ace Hardware, and the next 10 times you go on the internet, there's wheelbarrow ads everywhere you look. You know, we don't do that. We don't put tracking cookies. We don't do any of that. So there's no algorithms behind there that are going to try to, if they perceive you to be a left winger, they'll give you left wing articles. They perceive you to be a right winger, they'll give you articles that have some right wing influence. But
if they perceive you to be a conspiracy theorist, increasingly they're starting to try to put stuff up that they're hoping will cure you. It's just started. I've noticed this. It used to be that you watch, you know, the Sandy Hook, Jim Fetzer video or whatever, and a whole lot of other similar things popped up. There's still a lot of that on YouTube, but now I'm actually starting to see, I think I saw this first mostly on Facebook, where the stuff is starting to show up that is basically sort of the anti-conspiracy propaganda. So if you watch a Parkland shooting conspiracy video, you might be steered towards some sort of, you know, mainstream piece about the, you know, downside of being a conspiracy theorist kind of thing. And there's more and more of that now. So they're like openly following the Cass Sunstein model of trying to stop the conspiracy theorists by disabling the purveyors of conspiracy theories, nudging people away from them. You know, what was his phrase about trying to feed people more information to, like, broaden their cognitive, whatever it was. But they're doing this now. They're really trying to herd the sheep into the same pen online. And what you're doing here is, in fact, what the internet really should be about. And frankly, I think what you're doing is the only thing that should be legal, because I think that just as in the old days when we didn't have the internet, we only had the telephone company. If the telephone company kept track of all your calls and then you tried to use that for profit or, you know, turn it over to the government without a specific search warrant, that would have been an illegal criminal invasion of privacy. And likewise, I think the moment any internet company, Facebook or whoever it was that first started doing this, started actually tracking people, that they should have been locked up in federal prison. So what you're doing is the only thing that should be legal. These other people, the heads of these big internet companies should all be facing life in federal prison for invasion of privacy.
And not just the head not just the CEO, but the top 100 executive managers and the board of directors. Lock them up.
All of them. Yeah, all the decision makers that committed this, conspired to commit this crime.
But let me go on a little further about what we have is on this platform is not only do we have a Facebook replacement, but we've also developed a YouTube replacement. Because YouTube has been, again, you know, they're a Google-owned asset. They've been censoring and kicking people off and confiscating archives of, you know, hundreds of recordings, interviews, presentations that people have made, and they're disappearing into the black hole. So we said that this is not right. This is not fair. This is not protected free speech. And so we built this platform. So we said that we have to have a YouTube component here that you can go and you can access. If you make a video, Kevin, you can access your video. You can post it in an article. You can do anything you want with it. We have it there. It's safe. It's protected. And it's behind our firewall. It's behind our encryption. So even if we did get a hacker, it doesn't do them any good. They don't know what they're looking at because the encryption is so good. I really have to credit my business partner on this. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Chris Ford, really a prodigy, a phenomenon when it comes to systems architecture, programming, and developing these type of tools that we all need access to in this age. He's really a brilliant guy, and I have to give the hats off to him. He's when it comes to this topic, he is the smartest guy in the room.
Well, it would be great if this model could sort of take over. If it doesn't, though, my concern might be that just as what they're trying to do to us, those of us in the alternative information sphere, is they're trying to quarantine us. You know, they're actually using this disease metaphor, saying that the conspiracy theories that are like diseases that spread. And so the carriers have to be quarantined.
The virus of the mind, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So they're trying to force us into our little playpens on the Internet. And what they're panicking about is that our stuff gets out and reaches people who haven't heard of it yet. So that's what really scares them. And in order to try to stop that, you know, that's what drives so much of their propaganda, you know, labeling us with these insulting terms. And, you know, they're doing everything to make sure that we don't reach the people who are not yet aware of these things. Now, if those of us who are aware all move off into this parallel internet that's protected by encryption and it's got smart people like us on it and so on and so forth. Of course, the good side is that that's where we want to be because we're hanging out with the people we want to hang out with. But the downside is that when we share stuff there, we're preaching to the converted. Whereas when we share subversive stuff on Facebook, not so much. I mean, I think part of the reason Trump was elected, and that's a mixed blessing, of course, but part of the reason that Trump was able to blow up the Republican Party during the primaries and somehow get elected president of the United States on a very, you know, unconventional platform, to say the least, is that the, you know, ordinary folks, not the Russian bots, but the ordinary people were sharing these alternative interpretations of things, some of which Trump was picking up on and using. And it reached a lot of people because the ordinary people, they all, you know, have a family member, friend or whatever, who's kind of a conspiracy theorist. He's on their Facebook list. Or so on their Facebook page, suddenly something pops up about 9/11 being an inside job or what have you. And they get aware of that stuff and then they get disaffected and they end up like voting for Trump to, you know, let's blow up the system and elect Trump, you know. So there, Trump's election, I think, is an example of the power of the alternative information sphere, for better or worse, and a little bit of both. But if we all go off into this alternative side of the internet, let's say everybody signs up for VTTV who already knows this stuff, then we abandon the other fora, and the sheeple will suddenly start seeing nothing but stuff targeting sheeple.
I see where you're going on this. I think you make a very, very good point. But here's what's happened. I'm glad you brought up 9/11 because everybody in America knows that the 9/11 story, the official story, is a bunch of bunk. Everybody knows it. I don't know anybody except the newscasters on CNN and Fox News who actually pretend to believe that's the real story. We know it's not. But what's a deeper issue than that is that we're living, since 9/11 and the passage of the Patriot Act and the NDAA, we're living in a post-constitutional country. We no longer enjoy the protections that we once had, the right of due process, this rendition business, all of these things. We're not supposed to be aware of it yet. And that's one of the reasons that they're so afraid of the alternate media and the job we're doing. And that's one of the reasons that we had to build this platform, is to protect free speech so that, you know, they may label us, they may call us nut jobs, they may disparage us in many, many ways. But I think a lot of us have our heads screwed on straight, and we tell people, we talk to people, and we're going to continue to talk to people. And, you know, build it and they will come. And so we built it, and now we hope that people will come. And I hope they enjoy not being data mined and not being profiled and not having ads targeted to them every time they go online. It might be refreshing for people to actually be able to make their own decisions without this very subtle, subliminal influence that Facebook and other medias put on us when we spend our time in front of our computer.
And here's a way that we could overcome the problem that I was sketching, and that is we could do, of course, most of our most interesting socializing in this VTTV alternative encrypted platform where we're not being spied on, and our data isn't being mined, and we're not being censored. And then the best information that we're going to get, when we're going to be probably getting better information from that world, then we can keep that Facebook account and just use it to post good alternative stuff, you know? So we don't have to stop preaching to the non-converted simply because we've moved into this arena that's mostly populated by the converted.
Well, that's the point. We're trying to make a repository here. And one of our strategy meetings we had today was that one of the things we're going to do is reach out to everybody we can in the alternate media and say, you know, if you're a content provider, you know, we charge $6, $5.99 a month. But if you want to protect your content and not have it taken down, not have it hacked, not have it disappear, you can we can be a repository for all that, to where even if YouTube deletes all 1,400 of your one-hour interviews, we still have them on file, and we can give them back to you, and you can repost them again anywhere else you want. So we're trying to take a multiple-tiered approach here, to where no matter what we do, we have choices. And that's the thing, is to give ourselves more choices, more options as to how we present, package, and protect our information, our knowledge base that we have out there, because leaving it in the hands of the Facebooks and the Googles and the YouTubes, they're not to be trusted. And so here we are. We're a really cheap, cost-effective insurance policy. That's it.
So when I first saw these twin tiers where ordinary people would pay $1.99 and the content providers would pay, what is it, $5.99?
Yes, $5.99, correct.
And my first thought was, that's weird, like, because as a professional content provider, normally I get paid to provide content. I don't pay to put my content up. So the rationale for this is basically that we're taking up more storage space. Is that it? Like, we're posting videos and
there's a space, there's a bandwidth issue. There's all these things, and we've tried to keep both of them really as cheap and cost effective. I mean, we have to have some method to pay for our servers and the bandwidth that we buy from the fiber optics providers. We have to have a way to do that. That's the only reason we charge anything. We could give it away for free, we would. But then we'd have to have a revenue stream to pay our overhead. So next thing you know, we're data mining.
Right. And yeah, it's a nasty, vicious circle, isn't it?
It is, and that's one of the things about VT.com, RetroStay.com, that I like, is that VT never takes the advertising revenue. There's advertising revenue that's put on there by Google Ads and all that kind of stuff, but the VT people don't see it. And the reason behind that, you can talk to Gordon about it, is that we don't want to become dependent upon advertisers who can then say, well, we don't like your position on what Israel's doing this week, so we're going to pull our ads unless you change your position. We don't want to give people that leverage. And so we charge, like I said, a small fee, and we don't want to give anyone that leverage either. We don't want to be dependent upon the big client out there, whether it's the U.S. government or General Motors or, you know, General Electric, who knows? We don't want to be the guys who screw up and lose the big account, lose our revenue stream. So we're going to depend on the people to provide us, which is what it should be. You know, they're the end users. And like I said earlier, if you don't pay for the product, you are the product.
So how are you going to build a critical mass? Because the way these things always work is that they kind of snowball, and you got to have a critical mass to, you know, to really get them working. I can imagine, you know, you could let the big internet people, you know, give you enough rope to hang them with. You could be actually buying targeted ads on Facebook, for example, targeting people who are aware of, let's say, 9/11 Truth and NSA spying, and telling them, you know, what are you doing on Facebook, you idiot? Come over to VTTV. I wonder if Facebook would let you run ads like that.
You know, I don't know if it lets run ads, but I've posted the article on my Facebook page, and they haven't kicked me off yet. But, yeah. You know, we've got so many things that here. You know, we've got the Facebook replacement. We've got a YouTube replacement. We've got a live radio option. If you want to do your podcast, we'll host them. We've got them. They're protected. They're behind our firewall. They're fully encrypted. We've got live television. If you want to do a live TV podcast, we've got it. We can, you know, give you anything you want. We can even put a green screen behind you and provide a backdrop so it looks like you're sitting in a studio equivalent to Fox News someplace. We have all of these resources available that, again, my partner, Chris Ford developed. Like I said, he's the brains in the outfit technically. He really is. We've got a live chat, feature on there that you can chat back and forth live like you do on Skype and things. Except it's fully encrypted. Nobody can, even if anyone could intercept it, they can't read it. We've got live video conferencing. So we do that on multiple scales. We go one-to-one, a point-to-point, or we could have a group video conference. If you want to have 5, 10, you know, 20 people on there, we can do that. We have all of these capabilities here that we're making available to people for really, you know, almost free. $2 a month is almost free.
This reminds me a little bit of the way people talked about Bitcoin back when it first came out. And I remember, you know, having these conversations like, oh, this is too good to be true. You're talking, you know, this is so well encrypted. This cryptocurrency is so well encrypted that the biggest powers on earth can't blow it up, steal it, hack it, whatever. And you think they're going to let you get away with this? I don't know. You know, I was skeptical. And so, unfortunately, I didn't invest what little I had in Bitcoin at that point. But as it turned out, the mathematics behind this sort of thing favor the encrypted data over the person trying to decrypt it. I remember discussing this back. I was in the first university seminar on cyberspace. It was held at San Francisco State University in, I think, that about 1990. And the professor was a guy named Arthur Chandler, who's a terrific guy. Shout out to Arthur if you're listening. I just got a notice that Arthur is following me on Quora, so maybe he follows me on the radio too. But anyway, in the seminar on cyberspace, one of the most interesting points that came up was that the structure of the internet does really favor privacy in that it's mathematically much easier to encrypt than to decrypt. And the more complex it gets, the more exponentially hard it gets to decrypt. So theoretically, there's really no reason why we shouldn't all have total privacy for everything we do on the internet. It's very, very cheap and easy to do that. And it's very, very hard and expensive for anybody to try to bust into our privacy. And of course, this is a nightmare for the alphabet agencies. And so I would think that just like with Bitcoin, that there would, you know, just like that threatened the currency systems, and now the petro from Venezuela threatens them even more, they're going to react one way or another. So, you know, but thinking about what happened with Bitcoin, which doesn't show any sign of stopping, you know, you may have something that's the equivalent of early Bitcoin.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. Now, I'm going to let a cat out of the bag here because we just today signed a letter of intent with major content providers for Time Warner, Spectrum, and Dish Network, that if we could get 100,000 subscribers on our system, that they will give us 4 live channels on national cable networks. And so this is really us pushing back. Yes, cool. This is us. We can hit the critical mass of 100,000 people. We can take all of the people who are contributors, who are paying the $5.99, who are adding content, pick and choose the best content, and we have up to 4 channels to fill up. But we have to have 100,000 people as subscribers. We have to maintain those subscribers for a period of 90 days or 3 months. But once we cross that threshold, then we're into every living room. We're into 185 million living rooms in the United States alone, because that's how many people subscribe to cable. And we will be able to break the back of the Facebooks, the YouTubes, and anybody who's trying to squash the alternate media. we're going to be in the living room right next to Fox TV and right next to CNN. So let them try to crush us then. So,
wow.
You know, that's, you know, I had a long conference call today with my partner, Chris Gordon and Jim Dean, today about this and what strategies we're going to, develop and refine in order to reach that critical mass. So, anybody out there who's listening, if you have an interest in this at all, please, you know, go to our website. It's www.veteranstodaytv.com. And so, you know, go there, look it over, sign up, register, pay your $2. And, you know, it's not going to break you. It's less than 10 cents a day for a month. I mean, it's chump change. It's cheap as we can make it. But, what it does is it protects these critical voices, dissenting voices from the government story. Do you really want your kids to learn that 9/11 is what they told us it was? Is that what you want your kid to learn at school? No, not me. I want them to learn that with the truth about 9/11, whatever that may be. I've got various theories. I have my own opinions. I'll keep those to myself for now. But I want my kid, or my grandkids in this case, to be able to listen to what really happened and not believe, you know, the government propaganda that they're forcing down our throat. So it's simple.
Yeah, if we get this on the cable, I would think there would be some pushback. You know, the Zionists managed to get Press TV taken down from satellite and cable. You'll never find Press TV on American cable systems. I don't think it ever made it to them, but now it's off the satellites as well as in Europe. RT, I think, has somehow managed to survive on a lot of cable systems, but there's a lot of pushback, as you may have noticed. This Trump-Russia thing seems engineered to do a lot of things, including push back against Russia, demonize Russia, etc., and also to go after the alternative media by claiming that people like us are just Russian agents. So there's already a lot of pushback over things like RT, which have managed to get a pretty sizable audience and to get onto cable TV. If VTTV were to get on cable TV, I would imagine that the same people who were tearing their hair out about RT would be, you know, tearing even more hair out.
Well, you know, that's where we have, well, I want them to tear their hair out. I want them to be so full of despair they commit suicide. You know, that's what I want the Zionists to do, because we can't live in this world and let them succeed in their globalist one world government thing. And whenever you hear the word Zionism or globalism, think about communism, because that's really what it comes down to. They just put a corporate face on it for the time being, but the end result is the same. And we're seeing it. We're seeing concentration of more and more wealth into fewer and fewer hands. And it's, you know, when you're a peasant, when you're a serf and you're getting your one bowl of gruel a day to eat and sustain yourself, doesn't matter what you call the system is oppressive. And, like I said, we have a good thing in this country, and it's been slowly eroded over the past, 100 plus years since 1913, gained more traction 70 years ago at the end of World War II. But this is us fighting back. This is another way of fighting back. We've always known that the next battlefield is not going to be nuclear. It's not going to be, you know, guns in the street, we hope. But it's going to be for the hearts and minds of the American people. And we're going to keep doing our job and providing a platform that protects free speech, that protects the Second Amendment, that protects the rights of all Americans here. And that's why we're doing this project. We're not going to let these rat bastards win. Just not going to let them. So,
well, you know, I think my audience would be very interested in this. I do have subscribers at my radio show blog, and if people want to join and subscribe, just go to truthjihad.com, click on the subscribe link there. I've got two subscription systems there, and then we do a fundraiser for False Flag Weekly News. So what I do has no advertisements whatsoever, no snake oil like you might get from certain other alternative media people, nothing like that. And so people, you know, the people who are keeping me going are people who recognize that it's worth paying a few bucks to have better information. And that's precisely what this VTTV project is offering on a really big scale. And I think it's a better model, but then the question is sort of how do you support yourself, say, broadcasting for VTTV? And I suppose the broadcasters can sell advertisements, or they can solicit donations, and sort of the way I'm already doing.
Absolutely. The broadcasters, you know, will sell advertisement. That's what they do. They've got the pipeline to do it. It's already filled and primed. But one thing, other thing about our VTTV project, if you sign up as a contributor, Kevin, you pay the $5.99, you can run your own commercials on our venue and you get the revenue from them. You know, from the advertisers and it's yours. We don't interfere in that. That's all your money. We don't dabble with that. We don't take it. But it's just another way. There's another feature that we're developing. We're not ready with this one yet. We just started this one, but we're going to create an alternative to PayPal, because getting paid and having PayPal kick people off who sell products or whatever on their websites and things is another way of dismantling the alternative media. So we would be remiss if we did not address the financial issues. So we developed a PayPal alternative. Like I said, my partner Chris is still refining it, but we've got three big banks who've said yes, we will act as your container account for this, and we'll oversee this for you. So we're off to the races on this too. We're not going to sit back. I mean, these guys have had what a 15, 20, 25 year head start on us, but it's easier for us to construct parallel architectures to what they have than it was for them to invent the original architecture. So we're going to catch up with them very, very quickly and hopefully surpass them and leave them in the dust. That is our goal.
Well, you know, since your threshold here is 100,000 subscribers, I think of various ways of getting there. And if this were me brainstorming if I'm your business partner, which I guess in a sense I sort of am, I'm going to be migrating over there at some point here pretty soon. I would be thinking, finding somebody with a pretty big audience already, like, for instance, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, somebody like Alex Jones or Mike Adams or the, you know, I don't know who's got the big audiences these days entirely, but, you know, a tiny fraction of the audience of some of these people would do it. And the whole thing would be, they'd be on cable nationwide. Like, why wouldn't they want to do that?
Well, Kevin, great minds think alike, and sometimes so do we. the past several days here, I've sent emails and the article that was in Veterans Today to Alex Jones. I've sent it to Mike Adams. I've sent it to Dr. Michael Scala. I've sent it to a dozen other prominent people out there in the alternate media sector. Who have substantial followings, you know, I mean, anywhere from 70,000, Alex Jones' case, what, 6, 7, 8 million. But, we've been reaching out to them and, you know, all we can do is bring the horse to water and, hope that they see the merit in this and they take the time to investigate and look into it. Because, like I said, for $5.99 a month, we are one heck of an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if one would, you know, the people who are making money on YouTube commercials might lose their revenue. For instance, if Alex Jones were to move to this VTTV platform, he would, you know, and take his stuff off of YouTube, then he would lose his YouTube ad revenues. On the other hand, they're already giving him strikes and threatening to shut him down. They've taken a lot of people, a lot of really, really good people like Richie Allen off.
Yeah. So he's another one I reached out to, is Richie Allen. He's another one that I reached out to. And,
you know, I'll talk to Richie. I bet Richie would consider it. The thing is, Richie's working with David Icke's channel. And, you know, if David could move that whole thing on, which he might, you know, those guys might be motivated to do this now that YouTube is cracking down on them. But why it is, I'm not sure. I mean, Richie Allen is a very fair-minded guy. I mean, I don't agree with him on everything. We love to argue, but I have to admit that of all the people I know, I mean, he's sort of one of the very most sane, sensible, and really inoffensive people. To have him banned from YouTube, that's insane. So those people, maybe they would be open to this. I can, you know, I'll try to put a word in for you with Richie and see, you know, see what he says. I mean, I know he would at least give me a brief answer on, you know, what his thoughts would be.
Well, that would be greatly appreciated, and we'd love to invite Richie Allen, David Icke, you know, et al., Ben Fulford, all you guys, come on over. We got room for you. We've got a safe and secure home for you. But we've got more. See, one of the other things that we've come up with here is that you look at, remember Howard Stern when he was just a radio guy?
Vaguely. I wasn't a big fan.
No, I'm not either. I'm not a big fan. Didn't like him. Thought he was kind of crass, obnoxious, not photogenic at all. But what happened to him when he started doing live video broadcast? Suddenly his popularity went up exponentially. And so we have the format to allow guys like you or me or David Icke or anybody else to do live video formatted broadcast on a daily basis if they so choose. We have that capability in-house currently today. We can, if you want to take time, we can give you a demonstration tomorrow or Monday, anytime you want. But we have this set of capabilities here. Now we just need people who want to come on and learn how to use the tools that we're providing in order to advance the cause of what our alternative social media can be. Because if we get better at our job of delivering this message, we become more entertaining, more engaging as a presence. I mean, it's one thing to listen to an internet podcast on the radio. It's another thing to be able to watch it on your computer. Actually see a picture, see a guy sitting behind a desk. If he wants to wear a suit and tie, or if he wants to, look like Howard Stern, it doesn't matter. But we were offering like so much more than what has been available to the alternative media sector ever before, where we're offering them everything that the major networks offer now. And we've got it. It's here. It exists. It's up. It's running. You know, it's a pretty cool thing, actually.
It sounds pretty good. Is there any kind of built-in situation like Patreon or Fundraiser, these kinds of deals that help you get paid for putting out your content? Because that's kind of my bread and butter right now.
How do people make a living doing this? How do they make it worth their while to invest the time? This is something that my partner Chris and I are still modeling, still developing. But you know, it's going to depend on how many subscribers you get. I had a recommendation made to me that if you get 1,000 views, you make $1. And so if you have 1,000,000 views, you make $10,000. That type of thing. There's a scheme in here. We don't have this refined yet. We're still working with how to monetize this for the content providers.
Well, the problem though is you're not getting money. The 1,000,000 views is just putting more stress on your bandwidth. So that's the problem with not doing the data mining and the advertising is that if you're going to try to pay somebody for getting you 1,000,000 views, you're paying them to use up your bandwidth and not to get you anything. So issue, isn't it?
No, wait. We didn't say no advertising. We haven't done
that. Okay.
So we will still accept advertisers. And like I said, we're in the infant stage here. We're like a newborn right now. If you go on our Facebook replacement, we've got, 30, 40, 50 people on it. We don't have 15 years worth of 80 million, 100 million people putting content in. We don't have that richness, that wealth of content behind us yet. We're brand new, and so we're working our way through some of these things. No one's ever done this stuff before, and so we're on a learning curve. We're trying to do our best to come up with things that are fair and equitable, and yet can generate enough money to keep this thing going. And content providers like yourself, like a Richie Allen, a David Icke, these guys, this is what they do for a living. This is what they have to get paid for. They can't survive without it. So we have to develop models that allow them to do that. And that is one of our challenges that we hope to sit down and work with fellows like yourself to structure something that's fair and equitable all around.
And I can imagine that this is a process, a transition process that would take time for anybody who's moving over in terms of the content providers. Obviously I couldn't just shut down everything I'm doing with, my YouTube channel and my Patreon and my the fundraiser and the this and the that. I couldn't just shut all that stuff down, get off of No Lies Radio. Maybe No Lies Radio would be interested in coming over. I can talk to Alan about that, but it's a tough thing to try to imagine just totally moving over everything instantly for those of us who are content providers. But for an ordinary person who's more of an audience member, who's interested in this kind of information, if they sign up now, what are they going to find there?
Well, there's a number of things. You'll find the Facebook replacement where you're going to be talking to right now mostly like-minded people. That's, you know, we're in the, like I said, the nascent stage of development here. We also have a email address that we'll give you that is behind our firewall that is fully encrypted. And so by this, what we do is you can send and receive on this email account that we'll give you, but it's encrypted going to the addressee. So if you've got, you know, Joe Smith, you're going to send him a, you know, a secure message. If it goes to his email address, we also send a de-encryption key with it so that when the message hits, it opens up on his computer and it looks normal. You can read it. But if it goes to anyone else, if it gets rerouted anywhere to any NSA or Mossad or any other spy agency out there, they can't read it. All they're going to get is a jumble of numbers and letters. That's all they're going to get. So you get that. We have an internal telephone system where if you're on our network and you want to call someone else on our network, we'll give you a phone number, a dedicated phone number to it, and you can dial them up. It'll ring on their computer, and you can have a conversation like you would on your cell phone. But again, it's fully encrypted. And so we've done everything we can do to take surveillance, oversight of the individual, and protect it, all your communications every way we possibly can. And those are the things that we're trying to address and protect, because believe it or not, I think Americans, I think people of the world have a right to privacy.
Well, you know, I would think there would be a substantial audience for this among the people who, you know, not necessarily people who've taken the full red pill like us, looked into 9/11 and things like that. But even just the people who sort of followed the Snowden affair in the mainstream and maybe read an article or two in The Interceptor, those kind of people. Some of those people, I think, are pretty concerned about privacy and about internet spying and might be willing to go for this. So, you know, if you could find a way to reach them, that demographic, I think, would also be open. And those would be great people to get over to VTTV because a lot of them wouldn't be aware of some of the stuff that we are aware of, and so they would learn something from VTTV if we could get them there.
Well, do you know who really needed our services back when he was director of the CIA?
Colby?
General David Petraeus.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, I was saying Colby might have avoided his boating accident if he'd had better encryption.
Yeah, well, you know, Petraeus was having this affair with this woman, and he got caught because they went in and they read his draft emails. If he had our system, all they would get is gibberish. It's so encrypted that they couldn't have opened it. So,
hey, Mr. Petraeus, if you're listening to Truth Jihad Radio, you better come sign up.
That's right. And anybody else out there who's up to that kind of nefarious hijinks, you might want to sign up.
Well, this is a problem, though, isn't it? This is like with Bitcoin when they all said, oh, it's only going to be the criminals. It's the drug dealers and the pornographers and the prostitution people. Those are the people who are going to use Bitcoin. That was one of the ways they tried to smear Bitcoin. It obviously didn't work. Bitcoin has taken off. People like privacy and encryption. It's a great product. But I'm sure some folks would say the same thing about this, that what do you guys need that privacy for? It's going to be a den of thieves, of people like Petraeus.
and a bunch of terrorists out there to be plotting stuff.
That
with this
too, yeah.
You know what? that's nonsense.
Truth jihadis.
And the problem here is that the powers that be are so insecure and they're so afraid that they feel that they have to monitor everyone because they know what they've done. They know who is really behind 9/11. The guilty parties know who they are. And it's the analogy I like to give to people is if you and I are walking through the shopping mall together, we're going through a department store, and let's say it's wintertime, a glove falls out of your pocket. And a security guard picks up, comes up to you and says, excuse me, sir, you're not alarmed. Oh, hey, thank you for my glove. I appreciate it. I must have dropped this. Thank you. But if you're a shoplifter and you have the guilty mind and the security guard walks up to you and says, excuse me, sir, you bolt. Because you think you're busted because you have a guilty mind. And that's what is going on with the deep state. They know what they did. They know that they are going to be hung if they are caught. And their whole set of lies is unraveling. And that's why they're going to push harder and harder and harder to get more surveillance, more intrusion into your life, and more control over you, because they don't want to hang by the neck for what they've already done.
I think that's partly how 9/11 worked. I mean, it was designed to create this endless war, because if peace ever breaks out, then they won't have an excuse for these suppressions of civil liberties and this maintenance of this fear mentality. And then, you know, we'll catch them. Then 9/11 will suddenly look like a crime rather than an act of war, and we'll solve the crime and go after the perpetrator. So they can't let the wars end. And it was also designed to create an endless surveillance state. Again, because, as you say, if this surveillance state ever ends and we feel free again, then we'll be free to try to figure out what really happened and go after the criminals. So I think it was really designed to create this long-term war and unfreedom, as George Orwell would call it. And this is a really good way to fight back. And it's great to be thinking about creative ways to actually improve the situation. This is one of the more creative and promising ones that I've heard about.
Well, you make some really good points there, Kevin. And what it is this is a countermeasure. What we've developed is a set of countermeasures to the surveillance state. That's really what this is. And so, you know, they're going to have to come up with more aggressive weapons if they want to keep us under their thumb. You know, so this is going to buy the people who engage in this. It's going to buy them their privacy back. And it's going to drive the deep state monitors nuts. They're going to go crazy. But there's nothing we can do. And one of the main reason that we located our servers offshore is because if the Department of Justice shows up, they send the federal marshals in and say, give us all your database. We want to know who your subscribers are. We can say, no, we don't have to. You don't have jurisdiction here. Get off my property. And that's really why we did it. We're not going to house anything of this nature that is encrypted like this. None of it's going to be on U.S. soil. So just like the NSA took their stuff in their stream shaping operation to send it all overseas, so they're not under U.S. jurisdiction, we've done the exact same thing that they did. So, you know, put that in your pipe and smoke in deep state.
Well, let's hope they don't start thinking like H.W. Bush did when he heard about all the dirty pictures that Noriega had on him, and Noriega then was trying to leverage a bigger slice of the cocaine profits. Mm-hmm. So Daddy Bush sent the U.S. military down there to Panama to get Noriega. And likewise, if this became enough of a threat, you might have to consider the possibility that you would need some pretty serious security for those servers in Colombia or wherever they were.
Well, not only that, but we've got plans to open two other data centers and other locations around the globe. So it's never going to be on U.S. soil. It's going to be in jurisdictions that are exempt from U.S. law. So that as long as we obey the local laws, we're in good shape. And so if they're going to do that kind of stuff and take us down, then we've got bigger problems than we know.
Yeah, and who knows? But this is a really good moment for this, because technologically we're just moving into this big data-driven kind of stage where the artificial intelligence working on the big data is starting to take off. And, you know, there's some positive side to this, I suppose. I just translated the book from the French, Laurent Guyonneau's book From Yahweh to Zion, and halfway through the translation, suddenly Google Translate started working well enough to bother using. For the first half of the translation, I couldn't even use it at all. You know, I tried it a few times. It was worthless. And then one day, somehow they tweaked the algorithm. They, you know, fed it big data, huge amounts of good translations, and then it learned how to produce stuff that was like the good translations, and it got good, and it became useful to use it. It's not perfect, but it's at least a useful tool now. And in many other areas, artificial intelligence working on big data is starting to bear fruit, some of them pretty ugly fruit. And this is a good time, I guess, to start really thinking about your privacy, because if we continue to just be, you know, one sheep on Facebook and YouTube and so on, at the mercy of these increasingly more sophisticated AI algorithms that can figure us out with more and more precision by observing everything we do, you know, we're really heading for a level of unfreedom beyond even, you know, what we were dreaming of, you know, 10, 15 years ago when the Patriot Act came in and stuff. I mean, this is getting pretty ugly. So this is a really good time to put up a 512K firewall to protect our communications.
Well, what we're doing is we're getting closer and closer to Minority Report, where they'll do preemptive strikes before you've ever done anything because, well, he's pretty unhappy at work. He doesn't like his wife. He's going to go rebel against the government and try to bring it down. He's going to do an act of violence. We're getting closer and closer to that every day. And I don't want to live in that world. I just want to live in a world where I can mind my own business, be my own person, you know, work hard, make a decent living, take care of my kid and the people I love. That's all I want to do. I don't want these jackasses monkeying with me. And that's what they're doing to all of us. I don't want them spying on me. This is my business. It's not theirs. Get out. And so that's really the philosophy behind this. I mean, it's freedom of speech. It's freedom of expression without fear of having your thoughts and your expression used against you in any manner, whether it's to manipulate you or to control you in any way.
Well, that's the American way, at least the way the American way was supposed to be way back when. And I hope it gets to be more that way thanks to this great product, VTTV. It sounds very promising. I'm going to look into it. I hope some of my listeners will as well. Well, thanks, Mike Harris. It's always great talking with you. So keep up the great work at Veterans Today TV. That is the website, right? Veterans Today TV?
VeterancesTodayTV.com.
Okay.
Come join us, folks. We're waiting for you. We need you online. Come join us.
Okay. We'll see you there.
Thanks, Kevin. Mike. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. Bye. That's Mike Harris, my colleague at Veterans Today and a key guy launching VTTV. I'm Kevin Barrett of TruthJihad.com. Back next week, God willing, with more great guests telling it like it is on a live show. You're on Revolution Doc Radio.